this is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO Files program. The most talked about UFO book of the year, no doubt, is Witness to Roswell by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. We have half of that writing team back for a follow-up interview to the one we did in Roswell. Don Schmidt, you actually have been at the Roswell story a little longer than Tom, isn't that right?
Yeah, we actually had our first meeting at the Center for UFO Studies when I was still on the board of directors in the fall of 1988, and was very skeptical on the case and kind of tossed it around whether we should actually conduct an independent investigation on 1947 or not. And that was even after having met with Stan Friedman and his admitting to me at that time that, yeah, there were still many potential witnesses still out there, still people that should be tracked down, should get them on the record and, you know, find out what really happened out there. And, again, we thought this would be a single weekend jaunt down to New Mexico and wrap this up, you know, either come away convinced it was nothing more than a weather balloon or something else just as conventional. And we would make that trip in February of 1989. And we couldn't have been more wrong, because as most people know, we come away, you know, almost 100% convinced that as the witnesses are describing to us, that this was something truly extraordinary. That after now 60 years, and the government still defies, you know, the demands of the witnesses, the families of the witnesses, in wanting the files released, wanting there to be full disclosure.
How did Tom become involved with you? Through the UFO Museum or what?
No, actually, when...
The reason I'm asking this is, you know, when you write in conjunction with somebody else, It can be either really beneficial or it can be tough, and you guys seem to be a pretty good team.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And with Kevin, Randall and I originally, we were often accused of playing good cop, bad cop. And I guess that would be the case very often with the witness.
Yeah, I had Kevin on right after that book you guys did. Way back here, 89.
Two books, UFO Crash and Rock, the second one being The Truth About the UFO Crash.
And the reason I mentioned that is I assume Kevin was the bad cop.
No, I'll be quite honest with you, Jerry. Very often I was accused of being a bad cop. I guess it would depend on the witness. And to be honest with you, that was not even our intent.
That wasn't your modus of operation.
No. It would often fall into that situation, and it would work for us. With Tom and I, when Kevin and I were exploring this idea or this story that there were archaeologists involved, that they somehow had stumbled upon the crash site and had actually observed the remains of the craft and the bodies. And in fleshing out that very storyline, Tom Carey had come forward, and as an anthropologist, as someone who was just a dissertation away from a PhD in anthropology. And the original story was that this was a group of archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania, no less. Well, and Tom happens to reside right outside of Philadelphia. So it became perfect. Originally, Tom focused strictly on the archaeologists. And after eliminating the University of Pennsylvania, we then obviously attempted to determine, first of all, if there was an archaeological team out there and where they were from. And Tom was the one who, mainly through a process of elimination, it couldn't have been this university, it couldn't have been this group, it couldn't have been, you know, this group of students from this place or that place. And that's how he got caught up in the whole Roswell investigation. And started with Kevin and I, and then after Kevin and I parted companies, Tom and I continued and have been working on this together since 1998.
The reason I bring up this now, really ancient history in many ways, not as ancient as 47, that's one of the big problems here. It's taken 60 years. And we'll get into maybe memories and events and whether time is an ally or not before the show's over. But basically, the reason I brought up this history of your investigation is I'm very curious about one thing, just as an interviewer. Did the witnesses become easier to talk to as time went on? In other words, were they more open in 2007 than they were in 1998 or in 1989?
That's a good question, and I think it's a bit of a misnomer, as demonstrated with the release of the new book. We have seen that very often the book is being promoted, and the content, the new witnesses in the book, have come forward as though they now are, you know, gleefully stepping out or from the closet witnesses to Roswell, presenting all this new information, and that is not, and it never has been the case at all. In fact, if anything, whenever a witness has, you know, actually contacted us, that typically was a red flag. Someone who more times than not was looking for notoriety.
Right. A lot of people over the years have inserted themselves in this story.
Precisely. But we have always, you know, found that our best witnesses have been the most reluctant, the ones that we had to gain the confidence of, that we've had to go back to not only weekly, but even monthly and yearly. There have been witnesses that it has literally taken us years to get to finally go on the record. Now, granted, when the Secretary of the Air Force, in September of 1994, to the Pentagon press conference regarding Project Mogul, announced that they were absolving all of the Air Force witnesses of their security oaths regarding Roswell. Well, to us, you know, we immediately recognized that as a bit of a red herring because, first of all, there was no Air Force in July of 1940.
We all get in that trap.
How does the Air Force absolve another branch of the military, and that being the Army at that time, of a security oath? But yet we've still used it because many of those personnel obviously went on to become Air Force. And it has worked to our benefit at times when we present them, you know, that release. And it relaxes them. It enables them at least to come forward and join this legion of others who, albeit reluctantly, have stepped forward.
Yeah, you know, Don, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but the thing that puzzles me, I guess, or one of the things about the story that intrigues me is probably a better term, is the fact, are these people reluctant witnesses because of the security problems, or are they reluctant witnesses because it's just such a phenomenal, outlandish story to many people?
It's quite clear that these people have been sworn to secrecy. That is one of the benchmarks. Major Edwin Easley, who retired a lieutenant colonel, stated to us over and over again when we first found him in 1990, don't ask me that, I'm still sworn to secrecy. And no matter how often we tried to focus on specifics regarding the case, I'm sorry, can't discuss it. I am still sworn to secrecy.
You know, I've had that happen to me over the years on stories, and I don't know how to describe it because, to me, that probably would not be an overbearing thing if I saw something just incredible and I wanted to talk about it. But to many people, this secrecy oath and their allegiance to the country and to the military is overbearing.
Well, I mean, as you know, even former news anchor with NBC, Tom Brokaw, described them as the greatest generation. They certainly did know how to keep their secrets. That World War II, you know, generation, as far as, you know, when it even came to winning that last World War, they knew the importance of keeping their mouth shut.
So this was ingrained in this generation.
They came out of that war, and it was just on that very theme. These we're distinguishing the difference between the military and the civilian witnesses involved. Now we'll get into that in a second. But the military, all it took was, you know, getting them to, you know, swear I'm never going to talk about this again. And as it turns out, most of them did take this to their graves. They just, you know, they died with it. They died with the story of the millennium. But for those who felt, well, I need to at least tell my family, I at least need to go on the record and admit something before it's too late. And there's power in numbers, as you know, Jerry. And as a result, it also forces the issue. Because, after all, this is just a mobile weather balloon. There's nothing top secret about this any longer. So force their hand. Force their threat of retaliation or loss of pension or even worse. Because, you know, the Catch-22 is certainly greater for the government. Because if there were to be any retaliation, this would open up such a can of worms that, you know, likes we have never seen before. Because they'd have to acknowledge that it was something much more sinister, much more a threat to national.
Yeah, that's a good point. If somebody lost their retirement, put in jail or whatever, and they made it known public, that was a reason, because they talked about Roswell, that's a tacit admission that there's something there.
Something much more important than a weather balloon. But with the civilians, I think it's one of the reasons that they had to enlist the local sheriff in Roswell. They had to get the press on board. And they became, you know, actually complicit in these threats. The fact that with civilians, you can't threaten, obviously, loss of pension. You can't give them a military order. So in their cases, and we have many examples of how they were physically threatened, how their very families were threatened with loss of life, as you were talking about.
Yeah, evidently the sheriff, the mafia would have done him proud.
It was the commission to basically go from house to house, and you better do as Harry told you or else, because, you know, you better accept their threats as being legitimate, because, you know, they said they'll kill your family if you ever talk about this. And it destroyed Sheriff Wilcox. It was something, he didn't run for re-election right after this. And as the family described to us, it destroyed him. He couldn't get over the fact that he was used, you know, for that very purpose.
Do you think he realized at the beginning he was being used, or just after reflection?
Well, the two daughters who lived right upstairs from the courthouse, that was the living quarters for the sheriff and his family at that time. When Phyllis McGuire and Elizabeth Talk, the two daughters, independently described to us, hearing one particular day right after, you know, this had pretty much calmed down, after the balloon explanation had, you know, taken effect, and they heard a swarm of vehicles surrounding the courthouse, and they describe how MPs came in from, you know, each door around the sheriff's office. And how they stormed into their father's very office and demanded, you know, that he turn over that box of debris, one of the boxes that the rancher Mac Brazzo had originally brought in to his office, you know, on Sunday, July 6th. And they pretty much strong-armed him, as they describe and witness. And just the thought of the military strong-arming a law enforcement agent. And I'm sure his spirit was just devastated from that moment, because this was now after he had cooperated, after he had served, as you describe, as practically a mafia hitman, in securing the cooperation of the civilian populace within Roswell. And he never got over that. So I think he thought that maybe he would have received some accolades and praise for securing the cooperation of the Roswellians, you know, throughout the community. But that was not the case. It was not the case at all.
But
It appears to me, maybe you're a lot closer to the case than me, but it appears to me that government didn't really pat anybody on the back.
No. I know there were some cases. We've had some MPs who talk about having been promised rewards up to $10,000 for their cooperation. And even like Melvin Brown, who was one of the guards involved with the bodies, about the crash site. And on his deathbed, he even gave his family a bank security number that supposedly was entrusted him, you know, for his assistance at the time of the incident. And when we checked out such a number, it didn't exist.
I want to talk about Melvin when we come back. We'll take a break, so don't go away. The 60th anniversary Roswell Jerry Pippin Show t-shirt is now on sale. A limited amount of sizes, medium, large, and extra large, are still available. But they are going fast. This t-shirt is made of fine fabric, 100% ultra cotton. And the design of the alien skull will astound you and others around you when you wear this t-shirt for casual wear. Hurry, supply is limited. $15 plus shipping at shopjerrypippin.com. What actually did Melvin see?
Brown was with the K squad. He was with the kitchen squad at Roswell, and we always found that curious. But first of all, I have to describe how at the Roswell Army Airfield in 1947, it was the 1st Atomic Bomb Squadron, the 509th Atomic Bomb Wing. So everyone there had a top security clearance. If you so much as swept the floors at the PX, you had a top security clearance. Just was the nature of the beast at that time. And it was something that, as we were piecemealing and we were shotgunning the search for witnesses, even starting back in 1989, and we were wholesaling entire squadrons, obviously the MPs, the medical squad, that type of thing, certainly all the office. But we quickly discovered that that was not the case, that they piecemealed, that they selected individuals from this unit, that squadron, this group, for a reason. Because after all the dust clears, you go back to your respective squadron, you have nobody to compare notes with, nobody to talk to. Because you were the lone individual who was selected from, like in Melvin Brown's case, from K-Squad. And he was hand-selected, and he was sent out to the very crash site. And what he described to his family before he died was that he was assigned to ride back in one of the trucks, one of the medic trucks. And he was told to keep his eyes forward, not to pay any attention to the cargo underneath a canvas tarpaulin. And the first chance he got, he pulled back the tarp, and there were a number of the bodies. And obviously he was very shocked. He had no expectation that that was, you know, what they were transporting back to the base. And it was that many years later that it was actually the first man landing on the moon in July of 1969 that he took the occasion of admitting this to his wife and two daughters. And they kind of poo-pooed it off. And then in 1985, when he was actually on his deathbed, he brought it up again and kept repeating over and over that it wasn't any weather balloon. I was there. I saw it. I saw the body.
Did he tell his family what they looked
like? Yes, he described them as and under, you know, the darkness of the truck. And the skin was oddly textured. Whether that was a result of decomposition or not, one can only guess, but that the skin was already turning dark, but that clearly they were little people, that the heads were larger disproportionately to the rest of the body, and bodies were rather spindly.
You know, all of the people tell basically the same story.
The little people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that should add some credence. As I mentioned to you when we did our show at the Cover-Up Cafe in Roswell, you guys laid this out in this book pretty well. If you're in court, you'd probably get a conviction on circumstantial evidence alone.
Alone, yes. And when we think back, I know the skeptics always come back to this, well, you only have circumstantial evidence. Well, many a person has been executed with nothing more than circumstantial evidence. I mean, if it's enough to put someone to death, it certainly should be enough to at least, you know, get some type of a ruling in a court of law. And especially deathbed testimony, as we were just describing with Melvin Brown. And this growing number, and as you were alluding to early into the program, Jerry, how we're getting more and more of these reluctant witnesses, unfortunately, that they're passing on. Certainly the attrition rate for the World War II generation only intensifies. But much to the credibility of our research and investigation, we're getting more and more of these deathbed testimonies. And invariably, they're not only describing, they're not only swearing that indeed the incident did happen, but that there were bodies recovered. Little people. Little bodies, as they
describe. What about the story of the one living E.T. or two?
We describe the, we have actually two first-hand witnesses, and the one that we describe in the book, Elias Benjamin, who describes being at the hangar, P3, Building 84, and that is the B-29 hangar that all the witnesses involved in either securing the wreckage or the bodies describe on the far east end of the tarmac of the base. And Benjamin describes how they were on guard duty at that very hangar and were aware of, certainly the remains of the ship, the debris scattered all over the floor. And there were a number of bodies on gurneys being ready to be transferred over to the base hospital. And they were ordered to actually remove those bodies and transfer them to the hospital. And he described to us how, as they approached the hospital, one of the sheets, one of the coverings, pulled away. And he saw that whatever it was still alive, that it was moaning, that it was kind of rocking and moving from side to side. But the shock of what he observed is something that still remains with him to this day.
Have you gotten anybody that was at the hospital?
Well, we know the story of the mortician, Glenn Dennis.
Yes. Yeah, we've had Glenn on, and he's told us the story. And about the nurse.
Going to into the hospital and being confronted by the nurse, and then later her describing what had happened. We have secondhand testimony, which we describe in the book, of the base hospital administrator's private secretary, Miriam Bush, who was taken into an examination room. And secondhand, her too being shocked for what she first thought were children. And then she quickly realized that they weren't children, they weren't human. And then there, too, she described to her family, who we've interviewed, that one moved, that she was just as quickly alarmed to see that not only were they not human, but there was a survivor, that one was moving.
And I wonder how they treated the living one. I mean, how would you treat an extraterrestrial. Is there any medical records? I guess there has to be someplace.
Of course there would be. But one of the things that always, intrigued us was that the base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, was a devout Catholic. And we've always questioned the manner by which he would have even treated the bodies. And it's come to light more and more within the last number of years that the base chaplain was even called in to give the last rites to those bodies.
Interesting.
So,
Now, when we talk about this living entity, did it go to Los Alamos or go to Wright-Patterson, or do we know?
Well, all the information suggests that everything went via Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, and additional flights would go on to Washington. We've even heard that some of the autopsies, for example, were done at Bethesda in Washington, D.C.
Well, that would make sense.
That they would have had certainly the most sophisticated, most advanced medical facilities at that time. But regarding a survivor, one can only speculate. It's it's not like they were given a seat on one of the planes and transported, you know, off the base. It really kind of ends in Roswell. And I know there have been rumors and even of the testimony of from his sons of the Black Mac Magruder, who was with the Warren College at that time, and describing that they were sent as a group to Wright Field shortly after the incident, and were shown the survivor, were shown the living crewman from the crash just a few days before. So it again seems that everything, that Wright Field became the main repository for all the evidence, including the survivor. But as far as what became of it, we hear rumors of it dying within weeks or within a short, or within a few years after the incident. But
Can't really pin that down. Why do you think after 60 years the government is reluctant to even admit anything?
I think it comes down to, and you've heard me say this before, I hate to sound like a stuck record, but I still am convinced it's a cover-up of ignorance. They still don't know what they're dealing with. They still don't know from why, from where, from who.
Well, I kind of agree with you. I've come to the conclusion after decades of doing these shows that the government doesn't really know too much more than we do in many times, in many instances.
And I think it's still certainly a very political.
Because it was highly compartmentalized, and not everybody knew.
And not everybody knew, and certainly not everybody knows.
And so they don't even know where to look for the records.
To even look. My concern is, it continues, that the old order has not passed it down to the new. I've seen so many examples of officers within the military today. And as you just described, Jerry, they wouldn't even know where to start looking. They've heard this, you know, these rumblings all these years. And, you know, they'll be assigned to a specific base. And, you know, every base has its rumors. And one of the, you know, the predominant rumors has always remained that, yeah, we have physical evidence. We actually got our hands on one. And we have the body secured someplace. And there may have been a survivor, but where to look and where it is today, they couldn't tell you. So there's this growing faction within the military. Yes, they would love to see this all come out. But unfortunately, as I described at the beginning, the program, that most have taken this to their grave. And the grave is the greatest arbiter of silence of all.
You know, it may not even be so far out, but I've often thought that perhaps these records are hidden in some place that you would not think about looking. In other words, if they wanted to keep a real secret, you wouldn't keep it in the National Archives or what.
I think Alcatraz, you know, is the greatest example of, you know, containment. And it's one of the reasons that we've often, you know, speculated as to some of the islands, the South Sea Islands, where you have just total containment. And I know it's been speculated about some of the mountains within, you know, Nevada and up through Utah, that you also, if you go underground, would have complete containment. But again, I mean, we can all speculate, we can all come up with, you know, these scenarios of how something like this would be perfectly, you know, vaulted, kept for all eternity. But it still always comes back to just that you pose the question, why? Why do they feel the need now after 60 years to still bury this? Well, you know, again, one of the biggest stories of all time, and we're being denied, you know, the truth. And it's no different than when I posed the question to the late counterintelligence officer Sheridan Cabot. And I praised him for his patriotism, for his, you know, maintaining his security oath after all this time. And he thanked me. And I went on, I said, but Colonel, I still have to ask you this. What gives you the right withholding it from my generation? From all of us who weren't even born in 1947, you people have decided for all time that we're not, you know, to have access to the truth. And he stepped back and he paused, and I've never thought of it that way before. But then he came back with the retort, but I'm still not going to tell you.
And so, you have to have had decades of frustration.
Truly. And but no less than the people who were actually there. And when we were talking about memory and the fact that does time cloud, you know, their recall, their recollection of such an event. And the best example I can cite for all of us who certainly know exactly where we were and what we were doing is on November 22nd of 1960.
Right, the Kennedy assassination.
We will never forget any one of us.
That's a good point about if they saw an extraterrestrial crash, that would be implanted forever.
It embedded in their mind forever. And the point is, with the Kennedy assassination, most of us weren't there. Most of us, you know, only learn of it through the news reports and what we watched on TV that weekend. But we will always remember. But just think of those who actually were involved. And as though that should ever fade from their memory. No, I'm not a subscriber to this notion that as we get older, especially if it's a very profound experience.
Yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah, precisely, precisely.
I can tell you that since I'm an older guy now. Walter Hout, I want to talk about him, and they left due to constraints in the publishing business. They left part of your story out. I want to talk to you about what maybe they didn't print. I'll be right back.
The American Southwest, a land of abandoned stagecoach stops, crumbling ghost towns, obscure, overgrown wagon trails, all ghosts of an exciting and romantic past. But amidst the hogback ridges and desolate expanses of the Four Corners region, stories float about of secrets, whispers of extraterrestrial spacecraft, intruding galactic visitors from other worlds, underground facilities, and above top secret recovery operations. Come now on a journey through this prehistoric land as we visit several locations where some of the most guarded secrets of the modern age have alleged to unfold. Along the way, we will speak with some of the most respected investigators, reporters, authors, and lecturers in the field of UFO research.
Fallen Angels, the DVD that shows the mysteries that haunt the desert Southwest. Order Fallen Angels today from shopjerrypippin.com.
Commanding officer of the base at that time called me into his office and he said, I've got some information I want to give you and I want you to put out a press release on this material. The only thing that I felt at ease with was the fact that we had in our possession a flying saucer and we shipped it on basically to the next higher command. I think that a cover-up was designed so that they could say it was a Mogul balloon or some kind of balloon. Within my own feeling, I think that it was something from outer space.
It's Walter Hout on our bumper introducing this part, Don Schmidt, and you knew him quite well.
I'd like to think so. If not spending time together, we would talk over the phone on a regular basis, and many times, more times than not, we wouldn't even bring up the subject. And I'd like to think that's what good friends do, that it isn't just my all.
It wasn't a one-note Johnny friendship. He and Glenn Dennis put that UFO museum together single-handedly, almost. What was the, you know, he obviously didn't tell the story until that. We call it a deathbed confession, but actually it was
3 years before.
Yeah, right. But it was supposed to be released later. The affidavit. Why do you think he did that? Had the UFO museum to begin with, if he wanted to keep it a secret.
Well, it was one of the things that we had even discussed with Walter back around 1990. Our concern that as the story would become more noteworthy, that the outside opportunists would attempt to commercialize the incident. And Walter agreed with us. We were becoming more concerned about the historic preservation of the event and what type of a facility could, you know, house that commemoration, that information, become a repository for all the witnesses involved. And the museum certainly did and continues to serve that purpose. As Walter, you know, obviously becoming the president, becoming the director, and becoming certainly the greatest ambassador of the museum up until the time of his death, he, and as I describe in the book, as we both, as Tom and I describe in the book, would like to believe that his former commanding officer, Butch Blanchard, would look down and say, well, you didn't break your oath, as I asked you not to, but you at least are preserving the memory.
And, you know, I had the good fortune of meeting him a couple of times later in life, naturally, but I can understand that he had a disloyalty to Blanchard that was even above probably his loyalty to the nation and to his service.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more, Jerry. This was, he would often describe his closeness to Blanchard almost like a nephew, uncle. He didn't want to go so far as to say father's son. But there are a lot of nephews who are very close to their uncles and vice versa. And I think the best example is that when Blanchard died at the Pentagon, that it wasn't simply just a phone call informing him of his death, but they sent a courier from Washington directly to Walter's home with that sad news. So I guess, yeah, that's as close as one could actually get. That's family. And I think, as you described, his loyalty to his country was only superseded by his loyalty to his friend and family member in many regards, Colonel Blanchard, who would, you know, go on to become a four-star general. So much for his making such...
Was there any examples where Blanchard might have weakened a little and wanted to talk?
Well, there were times that even his own family, his daughter described that every time they would bring it up, and to her it was almost as though her father was brainwashed to some degree, because every time it would come up within family circles, she would describe how her father would go into almost this trance, and he would just stare out beyond everybody in the room, and he would always respond the same way, by saying, the Russians have some amazing thing. Well, okay. But his wife, Anne, his widow, Anne, who still living, says that her husband would always say that, well, at first we thought it was Russian, because nobody could identify it. But then after everything was tested and analyzed, you know, there was no doubt that the materials were not from here. Now, you wouldn't ever, there's no family member that mentions any descriptions of bodies or crewmen, you know, connected to the incident. But clearly, Blanche, I think another good story was there was a former mayor of Roswell. His name was Brainerd. And they were having a reunion in Roswell in the mid-60s, just before Blanchard actually died, for all the former base commanders at the base. And they were all sitting at the same table. And somebody brought up the 47 incident and what actually became of all that stuff. And according to the former mayor, all Blanchard would say was, that was the damnedest stuff. That was almost 20 years after the incident. And instead of just laughing it off and, oh, you know, yeah, everybody made such a big to-do over that weather balloon. But after 20 years, he still, that was the damnedest stuff.
So there's a lot of admission by a lot of the players that this weather balloon story and all the other things really is nothing but BS. I guess really they're all just conflicted. They'd like to talk, but they've got that oath.
Well, it's like the, I think it's been used in the past as an example, just the thought that as Clark Kent, you know, you're Superman, and you can't tell anybody. You just love to blurt it out to the world, you know, hey, everybody, I'm Superman. So just imagine.
Being a journalist and you're a writer, I'd have to write it down someplace. But I guess none of that surfaced any place.
Well, but we still have hope. So talk to family members, many of them who described, yeah, my father or my husband, you know, he had a piece. And I think a good example there is O.W. Pappy Henderson.
Famous name.
Who even showed a piece to a good dentist friend of his, Dr. John Kromschroeder, in the late 70s. And it was an actual piece of the memory material. And how, obviously, the powers that be were keeping an eye on some of these remaining witnesses. And who should arrive at Henderson's door, you know, within short of a courier from Washington. And I'm here to retrieve, you know, a piece of top-secret material you have in your possession. And that was the end of that.
Well, I wonder where that piece went.
We even had his widow, Sappho, you know, go through a lot of old boxes, and when they had moved to Hawaii, just seeing the transfer of all of their personal possessions, we had her keep an eye out if something should strike her as extraordinary. So let's just say that we don't believe it's impossible that someone still has a souvenir of sorts.
What about the things that are edited out in your book simply because you can't just publish pages forever? Got to do some sort of editing.
Well, one of the stories that was dropped was, you know, even the people up in Corona, where Matt Brazel, you know, supervised the Foster Ranch at that time where the Freefield was located. And we describe how that fall, at prom at the Corona High School, some of the kids were passing around a piece of the memory material for their amusement. As, curious to all the people who were there, and they knew where it was from. They knew it was definitely, you know, a piece of the real material from the actual crash. And there, too, what became of it.
Well, I know one time I met you at the museum, you and Tom, and I was talking to you about your search for the memory material, and you were quite, that was several years ago, you were quite hopeful you had found a piece, but evidently not.
And that involved a police officer, Fort Illinois, and his story to us of having visited his son in Albuquerque, and he just thought, well, as long as I'm this close, I'm going to go pay a visit down to the museum. And he described how he was in one of the local diners and mentioning out loud, being, you know, from out east and still interested in the story, and his elderly couple describing their involvement, and the husband saying, I'm going to just go and pick something up, and I'll be back in a short time. And according to the police officer, he turns about a half hour later, he opens up a box, and he's got a piece of this material. And they ask the police officer, go ahead, try to poke your steak knife through it, try to cut it, do whatever you can, do what it, you know, effect it has. And it's, again, a piece of the actual memory material.
Do you have any idea who the elderly couple was?
Well, I've met with the police officer. He actually, you know, drove about 100 miles to meet with me in the company of two of his deputies to vouch for his story. And he just flatly refused to divulge the name. But the plan was that he was going to go back down another trip to visit with his son and attempt to meet with them and see if it would be all right. Well, since that time, he's left the police force down in Rockford. He's changed his name. He only had 2 years left before retirement, and he leaves the force, changes his name. And I can't get him to talk to me again. So it's rather bizarre.
So it appears that maybe there was some intervention by something or somebody.
And I think partly because he made the mistake going public. A local newspaper wrote up the story of what had happened, and then we meet with him, and since then he's gone into hiding. So a bizarre series of circumstances, but every so often I think about trying to track him down again. But
well, maybe he's listening and he'll get in touch with us.
It's very possible. I know we know he's interested in the subject.
We have 15 more minutes to go, and Don, when we come back, I want to talk about people who insert themselves in the story and anything that you'd like to bring out as well. And there's some things I want to talk to you about members of the media back in 47 and what they're doing today, and exactly how many of these, you know, there was a local newspaper, local radio stations, there were people around. How come we don't hear from a lot of people in the media? I would think some of the media people would all be there knocking on the door telling us about these things.
I couldn't agree more.
We'll be right back. The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers, UFO and Alien Disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at shopjerrypippin.com. Don Schmidt, you know, this book is doing very well on Amazon.
Well, as well as Barnes & Noble and eBay and
your local bookstore.
Yes.
So a lot of people say, yeah, they wrote this because they want to make a lot of money. Like that's a bad deal. But you wrote it, and I've talked to you and Tom separately and together, and both of you are in this at this point. To get the truth out, I think.
Well, exactly. Research certainly comes with a heavy price, both financially and personally. Anyone who's involved in this field, family life, social life, often takes a back.
Sure. I mean, every time your wife wants to go someplace, you go down to Roswell.
Well, that's it, exactly. I think that before I married even, I was spending 100 days a year on the road, because it wasn't just going down to New Mexico. Wherever witnesses took us, wherever we had to track these people down, I don't think there's a state throughout the Union that we haven't made trips to.
You know, the listeners may not grasp how this becomes an obsession with a reporter or a journalist. When you're onto a story and you almost have the key but you don't have it, I don't know, I can't speak for you, Don, but it's a driving thing.
Well, it becomes certainly a commitment.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't drop it.
You just can't drop it because it comes down to, and as I often quote to members of the media, those who have been, you know, willing accomplices to the cover-up, for those who have gone out of their way to, you know, discredit and smear the reputation of witnesses, the investigators involved, and so on, all in the name of covering this up. If those people are wrong, who is guilty of the greater, you know, grievance?
Good point.
These people who have had the power to bring this out, to force the hand of the government. And for all these years, we've always relied on the press as serving as our public watchdogs. If they don't protect us from, you know, the government becoming too powerful, taking, you know, as far as over too much control, taking away too many of our rights, if the press doesn't defend us and provide us with the truth, then who's going to do that?
And, you know, unfortunately, in today's modern world, the press has let us down too many times. And I say that as a member of the press, but it's really very, very disturbing what's happening these days.
It is, and I think a lot of it has to do with certainly the Internet, the 24-hour news station.
Yeah, there's many, many reasons, and I've had, and many of them... Are censoring things, not realizing they're even censoring it, simply because, basically, Don, we in the media are getting paid a little more than we deserve, and you don't want to give that up. And managers and editors and program directors are not bashful, I can tell you from first experience, about, well, Jerry, you don't really want to follow this up because, you know, so-and-so advertises with us, and they probably wouldn't like it.
As you mentioned, yes, certainly the commercial aspects of the profession, but also, sadly, investigative journalism has become a lost art.
It's almost like people don't know how to ask questions.
Don't know how to ask questions. They don't know how to really follow up on a particular investigation, because it is so time-consuming that the news has become so instantaneous that if I can't start, you know, on a story... the first thing in the morning, if I can't wrap it up by that evening, it's not worth my time and effort.
Well, and the people you work for say, well, what have you been doing? No, you're right about that. It takes months sometimes or years. Let's just talk about some of the people in the media. There were at least one daily newspaper there, right?
There were two, Daily Record and the Roswell Dispatch.
Were you able... to find any reporters or editors or anything that were willing to talk to you later? I mean, it seems to me as a reporter, I'd go out there and try to find out what's happening.
At that time, they did. And I could throw out a whole bunch of names, even as far as the different radio stations. You had the Frank Joyces.
Frank has been around on the Internet here a little while, and he was aware at one of the radio stations.
KGFL. And you had Johnny McFoyle, and you had John Roberts, and you had Art McQuitty. I mean, these are all people who were affiliated either with the newspapers or the radio.
You're a younger guy than I am, and I certainly wasn't an adult in 47. I'm not that old. But I remember in the late 50s and early 60s as a cub reporter, a small reporter at a radio station, I was allowed to do some amazing things on sites. Remember one time bank robbers were shooting at highway patrolmen, and I was laying right there next to them, talking to them and interviewing them. I mean, things like that don't happen now. You have the press conference, and everybody's kept away from the media. But back in 47, I don't think they were as serious about keeping you away from the story.
No, but let's just quickly go through the scenario of even the timeline of events with Matt Brazel, the rancher, coming into town, reporting this to the sheriff's office, and the very first person beyond the sheriff that he speaks to is a member of the press. It's none other than Frank Joyce at KGFL, who happens to call up the sheriff's office to get some late scuttle for his next newscast. So, Joyce's boss, Walt Whitmore Sr., obviously wants the exclusive. So after Brazel has led the two intelligence officers, Major Marcel and CIC Captain Sheridan Cabot, back to the ranch, Whitmore sends somebody up to grab Brazel from his ranch. And they hide him out at his home that late evening of July 7th.
Well, see, that sounds like a movie, but I can tell you the media would have behaved that way, especially back in those days. I would probably do that today.
They grab the source. They grab the very person who came in with the story and some of the debris. And they put him on a wire recorder at that time at Whitmore's home. Judd Roberts even described to his grandson before he passed away bodies up at the ranch. But the military, obviously, in their attempts to contain and squelch the whole story, they're frantic to find Brazel, because Brazel's no longer up at the ranch. So who do they immediately suspect? Well, obviously, the members of the press. And they find him at Whitmore's home. And that's where they grabbed him. That's where they then detained him, you know, after even the balloon explanation. And they confiscated that wire recording. And we know that the FCC was enlisted to contact the members of the press, threatening them with loss of their licenses.
And back in those days, I want to tell you, that was before appeals and court cases. Every radio station operator feared the FCC.
They certainly did, because they said, you're going to lose your license.
Usually you lost.
You lost your license. And they even enlisted, they had Senator Chavez, Dennis Chavez from New Mexico, also call and reinforce that threat and say, it's out of my hands. If you don't obey what they, you know, told you to do, I can't help you. And as we started the program, and that's where Sheriff George Wilcox then was the follow-up man to then go to their homes and tell them, you better do as you're told, because they mean business. So that's how the press was not only enlisted, but how they were then used to basically, you know, shut down the entire story. And it worked. The military was God back at that time, especially coming off of World War II.
Oh, sure.
And they didn't have to tell you twice.
I understand that. We only have about 5 minutes left. Can you kind of give me a thumbnail sketch of what do you think happened that night with the crash? I mean, how many crash scenes, et cetera, et cetera?
I am almost 100% convinced that there was a craft, as we would, by today's standards, call a UFO, a craft of unknown origin, something beyond our technology, something beyond our human, you know, existence here on this planet, that for whatever reason was caught up in a severe lightning storm. And whether it was struck by lightning or an internal malfunction caused it to explode, raining debris on a site about 65 miles northwest of Roswell. The bodies were sucked out.
When you say a number, you think three?
At the secondary body site, about 2.5 miles from the debris field, Brazel used the plural term of bodies, so at a minimum certainly of two at that site, either sucked out, drawn out by the...
That we haven't talked about over the years is actually there could have been more, I guess.
No, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Because there was another body site. So along that trajectory line, that either through the percussion, the depressurization of the object, the bodies, a couple were sucked, were drawn out to that location, still on the Brazel Ranch, and then a pod, a capsule.
You in Roswell explained it better than anything that we've talked about. It's like the control room or whatever is insulated, and it turns into an escape pod, for more or less.
Right. I mean, we've had that type of technology ourselves for many years.
Yeah, right.
To suggest that something beyond our own planet wouldn't have designed such a capsule for such a
cataclysmic
event. And it continued on for another 30 miles before impacting about 40 miles north of Roswell. And that's where the remains of the crew and this pod would have been recovered. So we're talking three
separate locations. Where do you think the live ET was?
At the impact site, 40 miles north of town. From all accounts, it was at the site just north of town. And then hence the reason for the involvement of, you know, the sheriff, the fire department, all within that county, because this is within Chavez County, where Roswell was the county seat. So this idea that the sheriff and the fire department would have been involved in a separate county just would not wash. They would not have jurisdiction in another county.
Now, I have a couple of minutes left. Something you want to get out to the public here that we haven't talked about?
Well, I think some of the gossip, some of the talk about Walter writing the statement display nothing even suggesting such a sealed statement at the museum, where they could have truly capitalized on his admissions, his affidavit. The Sci-Fi Channel, in conjunction with NBC just a year ago, had offered to present Walter's statement on network TV, and the family declined at that time. So this notion that these people are always looking to financially capitalize on what happened, it basically, it still comes back to, they want the truth to come out. They want their fathers, their husbands, their wives in some of the cases to be vindicated, to be exonerated as far as for what they knew to be the truth after now 60 years. And after all this time, the government is still denying them, denying all of us that truth.
Maybe there's someone listening that has some information. Is there a good way to get a hold of you?
Well, certainly, even at any of our email addresses. In my case, it's Schmidt, Don, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, Don, 47, at AOL.com.
Right, and we have that on the website.
And even our own website, www.RoswellInvestigator.com.
And we're, and of course, they can get in contact with us, and we'll get in contact with you, too, as well.
And we always respect and honor confidentiality.
You know, I have not heard anyone tell me personally that you guys have violated their confidence. I've heard the third and fourth party stories of people who have an axe to grind, but I've heard nothing but that you guys are ethical.
Well, thank you, Jerry, and we certainly strive to maintain that level of professionalism, and as I was saying, we are looking for the information, not to publicize or capitalize on someone's name or reputation. It's the information that is the impetus for this entire event, and it's the very thing that continues to grow and, you know, raise this incident, this level of something truly extraordinary. The names behind it are just the names, but it's the details of the story, of the testimony, that, as we were describing earlier, is the very thing that would make us victorious in any court of law.
Don, I feel you're not through with this story.
By no means. In fact, even while we were in Roswell Festival, we were working on this. We were interviewing people. We were behind the scenes still, you know, tracking. And we have research trips planned for the fall. And interviews are still underway as we speak. And if you're still out there, we will make every effort, every attempt to find you, and hopefully get you to go on the record.
Good luck, Don, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
We will. Thank you.